Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Like a lot of you, our guest today is ticked off, and she's letting Donald Trump know about it. Our guest is Denise Merrill, Connecticut's Secretary of the State. She and her colleagues nationwide are pushing back against the presidential request for detailed information from voter databases in a quest to root out alleged voter fraud. Denise is in the studio today to tell us why she's not buying it, and thanks to Yale New Haven Hospital for providing support for today's program. Denise, welcome back to WNHH. So nice to see you.
Nice to be here.
And what I'm doubly honored that you're here is because last night you were up well past midnight, we were all asleep, traveling, hustling back from Washington on a plane. How was Bradley at 1 in the morning?
Not great. Not crowded, actually.
Really? But everything's yeah. Closed, right?
Yeah, because all the flights were late. You know, I think mine was delayed about 4 hours.
Yeah. 4 hours?
Yeah, it was thunderstorms. I don't know. I got here. Everybody said it was beautiful yesterday, but who knows?
So what were you doing for 4 hours while you waited for the plane?
Watching movies, mostly, and eating dinner. And there were several other people I knew who were on the same delayed flight, so we all had a pretty good time, actually.
Is that a little awkward, though, when you have to think you might want to be watching your movie or reading, and you're seeing someone you're supposed to keep talking to for 4 hours?
No, it was okay. We were all sort of in the same boat, you know, and luckily I really liked the people I ran into, so it was okay.
Well, Denise Merrill, you were in Washington on a mission. You were speaking yesterday to a group of House Democrats looking into some of the issues about efforts to roll back voting rights. Specifically, why did U.S. Rep. John Conyers and others call you to Washington yesterday? What were you talking about?
Well, yesterday was a really important hearing, I think. The Democrats were pushing back, as you say, against the request from this newly created Presidential Commission on Election Integrity. As I said yesterday, the most misnamed commission in American history, whose vice chair is a man named Chris Kobach, and he happens to be a Secretary of State in Kansas. And he sent a request to all the states requesting a large amount, very broad swath of information about all voters. That got everyone's attention, and there has been a widespread reaction.
So this commission was set up by Donald Trump.
Right.
He said electoral integrity because he claims we have a lot of voter fraud in this country, and he wants to root it out.
Right.
So they asked you, Denise Merrill, the person who's charged of voting and voting rolls in Connecticut, and your 49 fellow secretaries of the state, to pony up information about voters. What specifically is this information? Because what's interesting about this is you're a Democrat, but Republican secretaries of the state, some of whom also have joined you in opposing this.
Right. Yes, all of them, actually. And I think it's because it's the genesis of this whole thing was Donald Trump claiming that 3 to 5 million people voted illegally.
Wow, he threw that out in the last election.
Yeah, I think it was one of his many tweets or something like
that. Tell me if I'm in my own Trumpian but left-wing alternative universe. The fact I understood is, in fact, there was a total number of one person who was caught voting illegally, and that person voted for Donald Trump.
That's actually true. But there are a lot of people, including Mr. Kobach, and I'm sure Donald Trump, believe that there are lots of people that are voting illegally and they're just not getting caught.
Well, there is a history, right? I mean, yeah. There were dead people in New Haven who were on the voting rolls, and people would be sent in polling places to pretend they were they, and we're talking the 60s and 70s. Does that kind of stuff still go on?
Not as much, because now we have, of course, an online state voter list, and we didn't have a statewide voter list until fairly recently. The lists were kept in town halls all over the state, in this state and every other state. So it's very decentralized. The new thing, I think, is that we have the statewide list. So now, of course, we're having lots of issues about how vulnerable is the list. That's why you're hearing about all the security questions, who can get at it, who can do it, who can't do it. So I think that's kind of been the underlying issue here. Because what this commission did that raised everybody's hackles was that they asked for all this information from the states who are the keepers of these lists. And the secretaries of state take that job very seriously. They feel it is their responsibility to provide security for their voters in their states. They think it's their job to make sure that the lists are as accurate as possible. And also, you're really treading on their turf. If you're going to tell a guy like, Wayne Williams, who's Secretary of State in Colorado, that millions of people or thousands of people in Colorado's case are voting illegally, that's really a slap at his administration of elections. And that's why I think they're so upset. There's also a long history, of course, of the states being charged with running elections. It's constitutional, actually. It's in the U.S. Constitution that the elections will be run by the states. So you also have this whole federal intrusion kind of issue going on. And
you know, what's this thing about that, Denise? And this is a bipartisan opposition to what he's doing. But historically, it's the conservatives, the Republicans, who were upset about any trampling on state rights when it was liberals, at least in years of my lifetime, who wanted to use state authority to ensure the rights of people to vote.
That's right. And that's what makes
this
a
went 180
very, degrees. Yeah, it's very complicated, because now you have sort of the other side of the coin where we're saying, well, we want federal intervention when it comes to civil rights, but maybe not so much when it comes to
voter fraud, alleged voter fraud, for which there's no basis.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And so, and also, you know, this issue of cybersecurity, of elections and security.
And I do want to get to that. That's going to be part two.
Yeah.
But on part one, so again, I want to know, I want you to tell me if I'm in my own bubble that's just a mirror image of Trump. To me, from day one, this allegation of voter fraud without any evidence, except for the one case where someone voted for Donald Trump twice, has seemed to me code. I thought the subtext clearly was, from the start, we want to get black people off the rolls, and too many immigrants are here illegally and they're voting, and even though there's no evidence of that, that's what we're scared of. The black and brown menace. And that basically this is white conservative Republicans trying to keep black voters and immigrants who they believe, rightly or wrongly, will vote for Democrats from voting. And we've seen an effort in the South at the state legislative issue level, funded by the Koch brothers, organized through a group called ALEC, which works on state issues from the right, to disenfranchise black voters. That the rolls have gone down. They've made it hard. People have had to travel hours, if you're from a black area in the South, often to register, as opposed to if you're white. And sometimes with the collusion, according to at least the New Republic, of black lawmakers who have combined with black Democrats have combined with white Republicans to carve out districts that keep them safe, but ultimately lower the influence of Democrats who appeal across. Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And yes, no one's hands are clean, really, especially on the redistricting side, because...
Oh, God, no.
Yeah.
There are no good guys on that one.
Yeah. The argument is, of course... if they don't have black districts, then no black people will ever get elected. And there is an argument.
But then the other argument now in retrospect is that the people who want to lower the black vote are very happy with that, because then you just pile up all the black voters in one district, and then you no longer have districts where maybe a white or black candidate has to appeal across racial lines.
That's right. It's the old law of unintended consequences.
So now you've seen that from two angles, Denise,
right.
You were a legislator. Just yes. Between us and our listeners, were you ever in the room late at night carving up a district so you'd get reelected, or you'd keep your majority for Democrats in the House, even if that wasn't the best public policy?
No, actually, even I was not in the room.
No,
I wasn't
in
the room.
Okay.
I was not quite high enough on the food chain, and people were very concerned about it the year I was majority leader, and it was really just the Speaker of the House who was in the room carving up the district, and sadly, at the same time, he was running for Congress, but we won't go there.
Okay.
Anyway. So,
I remember him running for Congress.
Chris Donovan.
Oh, Donovan. I thought it was the guy talking about.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah.
Right. So anyway, yes. I mean, and actually in Connecticut, our redistricting process is relatively clean compared with a lot of other places where there isn't even any kind of agreement reached. It's just the majority party just.
We have some hilarious districts in New Haven. It's like you squeeze someone at the throat and then you have these huge feet and huge heads. But getting back to why you're in Washington,
anyway.
So what did you tell the House Democrats yesterday?
I told them that I am very deeply concerned, actually probably even stronger than that. I do believe that this is an effort to remove black and brown people from the rolls of voters all over the country. I think this is an effort to centralize our voter list for the first time in history. You know, there will be a federal voter list, and it will be controlled centrally at the White House. So the other thing that raised alarm bells for me was the fact that the request for the information was made not only with a breadth, I mean, the amount of information they were requesting was quite staggering, but it also was unclear to me where it was going. I mean, it wasn't going to be in some publicly available voter database as it is now, even if they managed to get all the information in one place. My question is, what were they planning to do with it? Where was it going to reside? Who would have access to it? And we were told eventually that it was going to reside on a computer in the White House, which says to me that it was not going to be accessible in a normal sort of way, which is why a group called EPIC, who's concerned with internet security, has sued the commission. In fact, right now, I think there are 9 lawsuits, among others, the NAACP, the ACLU, this group EPIC, who are all suing because this was done inappropriately without authority. So that's the other set of concerns. It's about, what is this list all about? Why are they collecting all the voter data information in the entire country in one place in the basement of the White House? That raises deep concerns for me.
And those concerns are being expressed by Denise Merrill, Connecticut Secretary of the State. Until, I believe, a week ago, you were the president of the National Associations of Secretary of State. So you must have been going pretty heavy on cable. They must have been beaming you nationally talking about this for the last few weeks. You've been the center of this whole thing.
That's right.
Has it been fun?
Yeah, I guess fun's the word for it. I mean, my job, it's a nonpartisan organization. So the question was, for me, how can I bring, what are the issues that bring us all together? Because that's, I guess,
great challenge in today's modern era, where you can succeed by working across the aisle, whereas in other realms of politics right now, you succeed by getting people to agree with you and really fighting the people on the other side of the aisle.
And maybe that's why I'm kind of uncomfortable with today's politics, because my inclination is to try to find the common ground. This was a tough one in some ways, because I think a lot of Republicans would agree with Mr. Kobach that, you know, we need to do everything we can to make sure, even if there's one fraudulent voter, we need to root that out and make sure it doesn't happen again. They are less concerned than I think generally Democrats are about voter suppression efforts, because,
right, in other words, that there are many other voters who want to vote, who legally can vote, who are stopped from voting.
That's right. And that's the big debate going on right now. How much has this request, by in and of itself, just by itself, and also all the claims of rigging and hacking and everything that went on during the election, how much is that influencing people's behavior? Maybe I think the damage has already been done, frankly. And the damage is done to the American psyche and to people now who mistrust their elections, really for the first time in a long time, if ever.
And this era is where the opposite should be happening, because the technology should be easier and easier to vote. And we've talked about this last time you're here. You think there are all sorts of ways we can do early voting, online voting, to make it easier to vote.
It's never been better. And by the way, 2016 election, from an administrative point of view, has never been better. I mean, you didn't see the long lines.
New Haven. You did in New Haven.
Oh, well.
New Haven was an absolute disaster.
It's always a special case.
No, actually, the election system is broken in New Haven. Oh. I mean, even last week with voter lists to use the Democracy Fund, which is our public financing system, they had us all screw up with the register of voters. They delayed that all week. But that's our at-home thing. You're dealing with the national picture. You know, Denise Merrill, one way that they can put you on the defensive, the Trump administration or the people back in these new commissions, say, hey, what are you so scared of? What's wrong with the average voter who doesn't pay a lot of attention to this might say, watching Fox News, why would these people not want to make sure that voting is completely legit and that nobody's cheating?
That's right. And I understand that point of view. But the truth is, we do a lot already to make sure there's no cheating. We have an election enforcement commission. Any citizen can bring a complaint, and they frequently do. We get lots of complaints. They are investigated. Most of them turn out to be anecdotal or not true, or, you know, have other issues. We occasionally prosecute people. People have gone to prison, you know, for voter fraud of various sorts. But so I would say there are many, many checks and balances already in place. And for such a minuscule problem to focus on something that just is so small relative to the other problems we have in election. Like, I mean, I think this cybersecurity thing is real.
And that's what you pointed out. You issued a joint letter you organized as president of the National Association of Secretaries of State. One of your last acts was to get the Democrats and Republicans nationally who are in that group to write a letter about this issue. And you said that the real focus should be on infrastructure, security of infrastructure, Russian hacking into databases. Is someone going to get in? And, you know, I was thinking about this a couple minutes ago when you're talking about having a single national voter database. Does that make us more susceptible to someone hacking in and to completely screwing up our elections?
Well, yeah. In fact, I spent all last year as president of this association explaining to everyone in the world, actually. I was down at the UN talking to the international press about American elections. How does it really work? And the biggest salvation for us on this whole thing is it's incredibly decentralized. There are like, I don't know, 100,000 jurisdictions and machines that are not connected to the internet at all. We're all voting, most of us, 85% or something, are voting on paper ballots that are, you know, we have lots of cross-check systems, we have paper trails, we have paper lists and electronic lists. But I mean, to centralize that all in one place at this point in time when it's so under question seems to me insane.
So that's why you're leading a revolt of secretaries of state against the Trump administration, against this effort. Now, in the last election, you were outraged, as were others on the Democratic side, when Donald Trump said before the election was over, it's going to be hacked, it's going to be cheating, you can't trust the results. You were here at New Haven City Hall with Tony Harp, the mayor, and you said, that's terrible, we have integrity, it's not going to be hacked, it's safe, look at all the safeguards we have in New Haven. Then when Trump won, it was the other side who said the Russians hacked it, there was cheating going on. Does that sound maybe it's not as credible to be switching sides like that? Or were you not someone who then turned around and said that was a problem?
Oh, no, I'm not. I still think that our elections are quite secure. If you listen carefully to what's being said about cybersecurity, even there was testimony a couple weeks ago in Congress about from DHS saying 21 states.
Department of Homeland Security.
Yes. Right. Sorry, the acronyms were hacked. If you listen carefully to what they say, what they mean is there were pings, I guess you call them. I'm learning this lingo. You know, there were people and entities and IP addresses trying to get past the firewalls in all the different states.
That's the part that's gotten me scared. When I read the articles about the election, I'm reading the main articles about did the Russians try to influence us through the social media stuff and hacking into the DNC, the Democratic National Committee emails. That stuff matters. I'm glad it's being investigated. I think the headlines are upside down. What are concerning me, and you said this just now, when I read later in the articles about how in the election in Ukraine, there was a section in Ukraine where Russia hacked into a database, and they were not able to change ultimately how those votes were counted, because as you said, there are paper ballots that can be counted correctly later. But what they did is they wanted to have people not trust the results.
That's right.
So what they did, and tell me if I have this right, is they before all the votes were counted, they went into that database, changed how the numbers were reported from the election day on the computers, and then magically Russia's official TV reported those fake results in the middle of the day. So they weren't able to change the outcome because later the real results were announced. But what they were really test driving was creating confusion so that people wouldn't trust the results. Now, if I understand it, in the lead up to this election, some of those pings, some of those attempts were efforts to break in to state voter databases before the election. So they were testing whether they could do in America at state levels what they did in Ukraine. Again, not change the votes so that Donald Trump wins or whoever can they have, but just have the results be fake when they're first reported, so that when they're reported later, everyone thinks it's not true and both sides say not true. Is that really the threat?
No. Let me put your mind at ease. The results are not reported through the voter registration system. See, this
But weren't they also trying to break into the systems that also relay the results?
No. No, because most states don't have those.
But we do. We have people go into a database to you.
Now do, but it is not connected to the voter list or anything else.
Isn't Russia also trying to break into that system that reports results? Isn't that what they did in Ukraine?
Maybe in Ukraine, but in the United States, most states still don't have that election night results reporting system that we just put into place, and ours is a freestanding system.
Right, and everyone but New Haven got you those results within an hour or two. It took us a whole week.
Yeah, but there's been tremendous pressure on my office, and thankfully we have resisted pressures largely from a lot of the registrars who want to be able to connect the voting machines into the election night results reporting, because right now people have to put it in by hand, and this is exactly why, because you still cannot connect the voting results tally machine to the election night results reporting.
So
machine.
Do we want this? Do you think that's a safeguard? Do you want us to say, be patient, wait a few hours on election night for a result, wait till midnight? Because you're going against a trend where there's such instant exit polling and estimates that people make. So they'd like to, and candidates do concede within 1 minute in some cases, and in some cases an hour, when in fact it takes hours to get the official results.
It takes more than hours. It takes weeks. In fact, that's exactly why we have 2 weeks to report the actual results, because our office has to be the official results. So there's a lot of checking that gets done and other things.
But the interest in disrupting our elections, isn't it in those first few hours when public perceptions are formed?
I think it's all about the public perception. I think the biggest danger here is not any of the hacking or any of that. It really is the mistrust the public now has in any results. I fully expect that the next election will be questioned by everybody now. And I think that has been the biggest damage from all of this. I mean, what I was saying about not being able to break into systems, it almost doesn't matter if they get in or not. And that you've just seen that, because they did not get into any of these systems, except one, I think. And that was back in July of last year. They got into Arizona, I think it was. And even then, they didn't do anything.
Right, they wanted to see if they could.
So the truth is, the systems are working. All these firewalls are turning back. Literally, I don't know if you saw it just today or yesterday, they said in South Carolina, 150,000 attacks. See, you have to be careful about the language here. Attacks on their system just on the day before election or something. And people don't realize that that's happening all the time. We get 10,000 pings against all state systems, probably all private systems, every single day. There's all kinds of people all over the world, in the country, trying to see what they can get into.
You sound very confident that the good guys, quote unquote, the people who want fair, honest elections, incredibly elected system, are going to be able to continually beat that back, that the hackers aren't going to win.
I'm not sure of that, but I think we're doing all
but
we can.
But one way to make
there's
sure
no
is to make sure
system.
There's no one national voter database.
Correct.
All right.
I think that's the stupidest thing we could do.
And you're hearing that from Denise Merrill, Secretary of the State of Connecticut, and until a week ago, the outgoing now President of the National Association of Secretaries of the State. So let me bring you back to states' rights again. So you're making the argument on a number of different levels that the best way we keep our system safe and secure the way it is now, to keep it in the hands of states. We said earlier in the show that puts you and civil rights advocates and greater voting rights advocates in the opposite position they were during the arguments over the Voting Rights Acts and civil rights legislation of the 50s and 60s, in that you sometimes need federal power to safeguard the rights and individuals. The state rights becomes a banner for actually rolling over people's rights.
Well,
are you worried that by embracing the opposite side, you might be laying the seeds for in 10 years, wishing you hadn't?
No, because I think what's happening here is that this is an evidence collecting method, I think, that the people in charge of this commission, what they really want to do is show that there's voter fraud so that they will create a false problem and then come up with a solution for it, which will be purging of the voter lists throughout the country. And it's just, I think in the end, what we're supporting is keep the protections that are in place, like the NVRA, the National Voter Rights Act, the HAVA, Help America Vote Act, which lay out the ways that you must, by federal law, not take people off lists. Those protections are necessary. I am terribly afraid that the net result of this will be proposals to change HAVA in particular, so that you don't have to wait so long before you take someone off a list. And you're seeing it around the country right now. In Indiana, they took off, I think, 500,000 people in one fell swoop, and that's a lot of people. And it's in court right now to challenge whether or not they did it appropriately under HAVA. Now, if you start having amendments to HAVA and NVRA, you can see how quickly we would roll back those protections. So I think what we're really standing for is don't roll back those protections for taking people off lists, for insisting that they have additional voter IDs and that sort of thing.
And what about, now you're in your third year of your second 4-year term as Secretary of State. Before that, you were state legislator from Mansfield, where you worked very closely on voter expansion legislation. Where are you with that now? What are the key bills you've been trying to get passed to expand voting in Connecticut, and where do they stand?
We've done a lot. We have Election Day registration in Connecticut. We have online voter registration. We have a version of automatic voter registration at the DMV. So we're doing well.
Yeah, there's Motor Vehicle Department, you can just sign up.
That's right. Yeah, now we just passed the 100,000 mark. 100,000 people have signed up to vote to register to vote through the DMV.
And how many of our, we have 3 million citizens and change in Connecticut?
Yep. About 2 million voters usually.
Okay, that's pretty high, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And what's our turnout usually?
Oh, depends on the race, of course. I mean, if you're talking about a presidential, we were very high this year, around 75%.
Wow.
Yeah, of a bigger number, too. So that's a big number.
So what haven't you passed that you're still working on?
Early voting. Any kind of change to our state. We can't do anything that all these other states are doing until we can pass a change to our state constitution. Early in my first term, I got it on the ballot. It failed on the ballot because this is something it takes a long time to change your state constitution. And it was a devastating blow to me and those of us who had worked for 3 or 4 years to get it on the ballot. I think it just got lost. It was a gubernatorial year. No one really knew what it said. Complicated. But anyway, I'm back. I'm trying it again. It passed through the House this year. It did not get on the state Senate agenda. And so
what are the main arguments for and against? Now, one argument against would be that voting should be your responsibility to show up that day. You want everyone to have the same information when they're voting about the state of the campaign at that point. Argument four would be make it easier for people to vote so we have more of a democracy. Right?
Yeah, basically. I mean, my specific proposal was to just allow us to have early voting, which means voting on some day besides just the Tuesday. Oh. So just, and it was a very modest expansion. It was like, I think it could be between 3 and 5 days, and it had to be within a week of the election.
But would it be a day you go to a polling place, or would you do it online? But what about online voting, like Oregon?
No. Oh, no. Oregon has mail-in voting. No one has online. No one has online voting.
Is that a bad idea because of hacking?
Yeah, right.
What about mail-in voting?
Mail-in voting would not be allowed under our state constitution in Connecticut. And a lot of people have asked about that. But again, we have to pass something that says, you know, we have a very strict provision in our state constitution, and we have to change that before we can do anything. So the proposal I made this time, because the last one failed on the ballot, I said, okay, how about a modest expansion, just voting besides on Tuesday? And because there are objections to expanding absentee ballots, for example. A lot of people, particularly in cities, feel like there have been some abuses of that.
There's no question. I've reported on that for 20 years. People fill them out for other people, fake it, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right. Although, interestingly, if you live in Oregon, if you voted in the last election, they basically mail you a ballot, you fill it out, nobody cares who helps you or anything else.
I know that the studies of Oregon say there has not been a problem. That kind of changed my thinking on this.
Yeah. They don't consider it a crime. I mean, they basically don't care if somebody else wants to help you. And I guess there are federal protections for people in nursing homes.
But the problem there is pressure. Like, I know you go to housing. I know there's a housing development a few blocks from here. Well, someone really didn't know what they were doing. Somebody kind of pushy comes in. They're not that with it. I remember asking the person to describe to me what happened, and she really didn't know what went on.
No. And that does go on. But there are federal protections for that, and those would remain in place. But, you know, it's all a question of who's enforcing what. But yes, so I stayed away from all that because I know there is an argument that expanding absentee ballots might be a problem.
But then what you told me is let's just get rid of absentee ballots. Let anyone not have to make up the reasons. Because part of the problem is that they were lying about why you needed an absentee. So I think what you told me last time you were here, and I found this influential, was because I always said, well, gee, I watched how they did that and then lied about whether they're too sick to get to the polls. And you said, well, let's not have them lie about whether they're too sick to get to the polls. Let's just let anyone vote when they want and make it easier.
I would support that, frankly, and I think we could manage to protect the people, the vulnerable elderly and that sort of thing through the federal law.
Right, that's where it really...
Yeah, that's really what people are concerned about. It's just interesting. I think it would require a culture change that I can't imagine in Connecticut because we're so used to fighting about absentee ballots. I'm not sure. It would take years.
But you know, the world does suddenly change. You don't know what I mean. Gay marriage?
Yeah.
I mean, do you remember how we used to think that was like even civil unions were just fighting for, and all of a sudden people, gay marriage and all sorts of people support that, and it's all over the country, law of the land?
Well, that's why the first time we had early voting on the ballot wasn't early voting. It was just, let's just take away these provisions in the state constitution, and we'll all have a debate about which form we want. Do we want voting centers by county? Do we want to do mail ballot? But it failed on the ballot. And I think it's because it said something like, let the General Assembly decide. And of course, you know, people don't realize the General Assembly decides a lot of things. But for whatever reason, it did not pass. So I was trying something else.
Can I get really small in the weeds here for a second?
Sure.
Denise Merrill, Secretary of State here on WNHH's Dateline New Haven and 103.5 FM live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Well, I'm very sympathetic to local registrars of voters. When we have some elections where they have to open so many polling places. Like we have a place, Truman School. in the Hill, where very few people vote.
Right.
We have 30 wards. It's one out of 30 wards, or career high. And like Truman School has a little sliver of the town of West Haven in that same district, even though it's in the Hill neighborhood of New Haven. And it's split between which state rep or which state senator supports them. So sometimes on election day, at a place where maybe two people an hour come in to vote, we have three separate teams of poll workers whom they have to hire. So like a career, it's like, because some, you're partly in a district that that polling place for one state rep, but a different alder, although that's a different year. But you have to have three official polling places within one because of how strict the rules are and rigid, even though it makes no sense, costs a lot of money. And that's one of the reasons we have such trouble finding enough people to man all these polling places and why we have those long lines and all that confusion. How do we fix that?
I have made several proposals, and they did not pass. The issue is, which polling place do you not open? And what it comes down to is the people who, that's their neighborhood, the representatives or whoever's in
question. So that's one issue. When you have a city with 30 wards, but it's right. Not an odd number of years. It's an even number year, so you don't really have 30 elections taking place. You only have seven different districts or six for state rep. Why not have six polling places? That's one tough question. But there's a different question, which is when the same polling place has to be carved into three official polling places because part of it is District 92 for state rep at Ward 3, somebody else's Ward 3 in District 95. How do we fix that? Because that's illogical.
Yes.
No one's rights are being – everyone could still go to the same polling place.
It goes back to the redistricting problem that you have overlapping districts everywhere. Torrington, for example, I think tiny little town, really. I mean – not tiny, but mid-size at best, has seven different ballots because it crosses two congressional districts and
five. We have something like 50 here.
Oh, I know. 50, I mean, yeah. It's the fault of the redistricting that is not contiguous.
But why can't we empower the Secretary of State to say, I give a waiver for needing 49 polling places out of 30 wards and we're going to let you have 30, or for the state rep election, we're going to consolidate a few?
I think the short answer is it's politics. Nobody would ever agree to give me that kind of power because they consider it, it's something that's politically.
What about a bipartisan appeals board that local registered voters could go up to where they're like two Democrats, two Republicans who understand election law, and you say, here's our map in New Haven. Here's this ridiculous requirement that doesn't make it any more convenient for any of the voters, that's tripling our cost and tripling our efforts to run an election. Can you give us a waiver?
If you're talking about districts, you know, state rep districts that are different in the same polling place.
I'm talking about you place, have
one polling place.
But you have to carve it into three because the state rep district and the state senate districts don't overlap and the aldermen don't overlap.
We can't have a polling place where there's a certain, I mean, it's a practical consideration. How many ballots are you going to have there? If we ever went to a sort of ballot on demand situation, you might be able to manage it, but I mean, really, the answer is to have three separate polling places, and that's not so great either. I mean, that creates another whole set of problems.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's think more broadly then, instead of getting you in the weeds. How do you picture in 10 years from now what an election is going to look like as technology changes?
What I'd like to see, voting centers, regional voting centers, where you could vote anywhere within a county, let's say, because you usually don't work and live in the same place.
So why is it that, you know, you might work 20 miles from your house, why not be able to vote at work at lunchtime?
That's right, because these lists are now statewide. There's no reason you have to have just the list for just this little tiny district in one place. You could easily have a statewide list and get checked off anywhere. And states are doing this now. Many states.
Which states are doing that?
Colorado, for example. Colorado is
so if I live in Boulder, but I work in a town 30 miles away, I could vote in a town 30 miles away in Colorado?
No, there's voting centers, so you know, and they're interspersed throughout the county, but it's a countywide system, and it's a big county.
So you can vote anywhere in your county.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that any connection to why they legalized marijuana, which came first?
Who knows? But yeah, and they also vote by mail, and they also, you know, I mean, so whenever I have a brother that lives in Colorado, and every time I start talking about these issues in Connecticut, he's like, what are you people doing? What is this all about? He said, this is just not an issue where I live.
So voting centers in the future, maybe within a county where you can vote wherever. Yes. Any other changes in 10 years?
Well, and I think you're going to see something like an airport situation where you come in and, you know, you type in your address and you'll get the ballot that is for you, and you will vote on that ballot and off you'll go. And so it'll be much more a ballot on demand thing. So you won't have have to order, you know, 20,000 extra ballots every election and that sort of thing.
And we do run out of them sometimes. And will that also help again with changing the rules so you won't need three teams of workers at the same place?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you have hope in technology's going to make it better.
But we have to liberalize the state constitution, and that seems like such a heavy lift right now. I mean, I'm going to keep trying, but that is the problem. We can't do any of these things until we get the lawful right to do them through our constitution.
So. I'm glad you're paying attention to the intricacies of the law there. You also pay attention to civics, Denise Merrill. I know that since you've been in there, you felt that part of your job is to just help people not just vote more, but learn more about voting and learning how government works. So did you set up a commission to explore ways to do civic literacy and projects like that?
Yeah, we did our civic health index just to see what people were thinking out there and how we could help. The biggest thing we found out was that people don't participate because they're not asked. You have to be asked in, it's a very simple idea, but very profound.
I remember a young Bernie Sanders organizer who's now doing other political organizers in her 20s, said, what did you learn? That's exactly what she said.
Interesting.
You need to ask people to do something, and then you can get a lot done.
That's right.
That doesn't occur to people.
Then we had focus groups with people like, there's a Puerto Rican group in New Britain. So, you know, we want to know, why do Puerto Ricans vote en masse in Puerto Rico, but then when they come here, they don't vote? And so the answer was pretty interesting. It was like, well, because you know when election day is because it's a party, it's a festival, it's a happening, you know, and everybody waits for it all year, and we have parades and election cake, and everybody goes to vote. So it's kind of interesting. They think that it's very confusing, the voting. There's always elections. There's referendums. There's this and that and the other thing, and they feel like they're just not clued in. And so that was interesting. It's a different concept of what it means to vote and have election day. So yeah. I would propose July 4th. Why not? I mean, we're already having a party. So
that should be election day.
Yeah.
General election day?
Yeah, I would say so. Or maybe if you're troubled by the fact that everybody's on vacation or whatever, you know, how about Veterans Day? It's a week later. What better way to honor
July
veterans?
July 11th is...
No. November 11th or whatever.
So a day already taken. Why not make election day a holiday?
Well, because then you run into this, oh, we're going to have another day off for everybody and... You know, you get
so say. Let's take a day when people are already off and have to vote on that day.
Yeah,
you think we'll get there?
I don't know. There's a group formed in Washington right now lobbying about this. It's called Why Tuesday. Kind of a good question. So
why Tuesday?
I don't know.
How does that happen historically?
Well, I think it's lost in the mists of time. I think it had something to do with the agricultural calendar, if I know how things usually go. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you do more like gleaning on the weekend.
I don't know.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I'd like to know more about
it. But it goes way back.
Any other suggestions going to come out of the Civic Health Index project you have?
We have actually instituted something in the schools with the Department of Education called Red, White, and Blue Schools. We're trying to recognize schools that really get their kids involved in their communities or do civic participation of any kind. And we've already got quite a few involved, and we're going to really ramp it up this September. But I really am someone who believes that you learn this stuff very young. And if you're not inculcating those values and those conversations and those stories about America or democracy or, you know,
I remember my favorite thing is when my kids were little and she'd ask us about these, you know, elections we cover. And I remember she said back to me 2 weeks later when we brought up something, aren't there diminishing returns to raising campaign money above a certain limit? I was thinking, boy.
Whoa.
Because I was talking about the Linda McMahon campaign that she raised $50 million, but it probably made no difference at some point, whether it was $20 or $30 million, so that it's not always the end of the world. You have some rich person who finances their own campaign. They can get those concepts pretty young.
Oh, yes, they can. And they know what's fair at a very young age.
Yeah.
I can remember like 2 years old, you know, what's fair is what, you know, my brother got and I didn't, you know.
So how do we look at this in the SWAT history? If there had been a Denise Merrill here 100 years ago who did a civic health index in Connecticut, would we find that people are more civically engaged and involved in the electoral process now or less than 100 years ago?
Well, it depends. 100 years ago, you know, you probably had quite a bit of participation by then because, of course, the laws kept changing about who got to participate.
Right.
And about 100 years ago, we had pretty full participation. By then, you know, well... Not quite 100 years, women were allowed to participate and so forth. But the big difference, I think, is that people felt, particularly after World War II, that it was their duty to vote, that it was their duty to participate and be a citizen. And I think that has changed dramatically. People think it's kind of an optional activity. And I think that's extremely dangerous.
Except Jews, at least in New Haven.
That's
the synagogue, Agudu, and the others.
Oh.
Everybody votes, and it's almost like a religious imperative.
Yes, see, that we need to get back there. And I'm not sure we're there because all through the 60s, and I'm kind of a 60s kid, you know, there was this whole opposite reaction to America's only for white people. So you had the whole reaction like, those aren't my stories. My stories are different. And we made a really, really great attempt to be multicultural and bring people in and talk, you know, teach different histories. But somewhere along the way, I think we lost our own. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to bring it back.
The reason I ask you about Swatha history, I've been thinking about a lot lately, because with modern communications, we're so much more connected to the world, what's happening at corners of the world, that if you look at news or social media, you could believe that we just live in a world where where poverty, where war, where rape and mutilation are just worse than they've ever been, and hatred. And then Nicholas Kristof had an article saying that, like, you know, until recently, 90% of the world lived in extreme poverty, and then now it's 10%. And that agencies that rate openness and democracy, even though there are so many horrible cases in the world, and there's this trend with strongmen, authoritarian rulers, that there's still a lot more open societies than there used to be. And that it's kind of like, you don't want to lose the outrage at injustice or the big problems we need to solve. But sometimes I think we lose track of the forest, and that we do take more steps forward than back. Would you say that, as someone who monitors civic health and the state of democracy?
I actually do believe that. And what strikes me now that I have grandchildren is they're listening to this too. Imagine the world that they're imagining. And that makes it seem much more important to me that we tell the other side of the story.
But in the meantime, you and the other secretaries of state are saying, hands off our voter list.
Because
there
yes,
is a real danger to voter suppression, yep, and trying to get just people to vote less in this country.
That's right.
But Denise Merrill, you're still the Secretary of State, and you can decide soon if you're running for re-election. Any previews?
I don't know. I think what I'm doing is very, very important right now. I'll say that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on WNHH to fill us in, Denise Merrill, Secretary of State of Connecticut, and the outgoing president of the National Associations of Secretary of State. Congratulations on your tenure there. That must have been exciting to be at the forefront of such an important national issue right now.
It was quite a year.
All right. Well, and thanks for coming back and telling us how that went. And we also want to thank Yale Haven Hospital for providing support for today's program. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all day and all night long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.